Right. We're going to pick up today. We had been studying the Crusades for some time. Last week we had a special pre-Purim shiur. We talked about different instances or recurrences of the Purim story over the course of Jewish history. That was lots of fun. Today I want to, well, at least that ended up well. That's better than the Crusades, right? It's like, at least like they tried to exterminate us and they actually failed as opposed to. Right. That's true too, but at least. At least it ended with some festivity. So what we have today is actually a little bit of a change of pace. It's not a downer in that way. And it's a topic that I've been interested in because it's a subject that when I was studying this material in college and shortly afterward was not necessarily so central to the discussions of medieval Jewish history, but recently it's made a real comeback. And that is the whole notion of the social lived experiences of Jews in the Middle Ages. When we look at historical writings about medieval Jewish history, many other areas of Jewish history, there's a major emphasis on the elite. So the elite might be the rabbis. The elite might be the political leadership. It might be the major events of sort of the epical, you know, seminal moments of Jewish history. So something like a Crusades or a personality like a Rashi or someone like that. Much of what we've been doing, and obviously it goes without saying, all of that is critical. And even in terms of some of the other events, so the Crusades or the anti-Semitic libels that we've been talking about, we will be talking about, so whether it be the blood libels, whether it be the claim that the Jews were responsible for the bubonic plague, whether it be the claim that we desecrate the host, the wafer that they used for communion, which was considered was a huge issue in the Middle Ages, and there's a tremendous amount of artistic depiction of Jews taking knives to little wafers, and this is something that you have. So these are sort of the major personalities, or the major moments, or the sort of glaring pieces of Jewish history. Those have gotten tremendous discussion over the course of the years. But there's a new trend over the last, I would say, two decades in historiography, the sort of methodology that we employ in the study of history, to say, hold on one second. Do we not have increasing information about everyday life as it was lived in, for example, our discussion presently, medieval Ashkenaz, France, Germany? What did the Jews live like? What was their experience in the 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th century, through the High Middle Ages, throughout this entire period? What happens on an everyday basis? Now, we do not have writings from the everyday individual, just too many people were illiterate and too many manuscripts certainly have not survived. That we do not have. But what we do have is, for example, historical writings. What we do have, for example, is halachic writings that reveal the cultural realities that were present at that time. So I can read, for example, a responsum, which a rabbi was asked a particular question and gives a particular answer. So if I'm learning it as part of a regular, you know, halacha shiur or something like that, so I want to know what was the question and what was the answer, and my emphasis is on just the halachic content. But if I want to glean this material as a historian, so what do? Look at it from a completely different lens, a totally different vantage point. And the questions that I ask, hi, how are you? Questions that I ask are along the lines of what happened every day? Right, what was happening in the community at this time? So the last two decades, as I mentioned, this is a new trend in historiography of the Middle Ages. There have been some great authors who have written entire books and substantial articles around this subject. Last time I mentioned one major personality is a man at Hebrew U. Many of the people we're talking about are at Hebrew U or Bar Ilan or what have you. And he's a gentleman by the name of Ivan Marcus. At the end of a class a few weeks ago, we talked about him. He has some very controversial ideas about the Crusades and even the relationship between the Crusades and blood libels, stuff that got people very angry in the early 1990s. And there was a lot of discussion about this issue. But he also wrote another book in which he analyzed something very quotidian, very, very simple, which is the ritual that they would undergo, a 5 or 6 year old boy would undergo when reaching the age of chinuch, as it were, of education. So I don't know if anyone has this in families or communities. You might have seen that they put honey on a wafer or on a book and the kids lick it. Has anyone heard of any?
Right? Seen this? You did this in the gun in the.
And the gun, yeah.
They have a big party.
And Chabad does it, right? So there's a long history. I think some Yekis still have this practice, or some variation thereof from the Ashkenazic piece of this. So this is a long and interesting history. And one of the areas, or one of the cultures in which this became very common, very prominent, was medieval Europe, was really the time period that we're talking about. And so they had elaborate ceremonies. And so Ivan Marcus writes an entire book where what he does is he reads all sorts of interesting sources, manuscripts that have not yet been published. He culls all the information together. And he gives us, first of all, the history of this initiation ritual of the Jewish community. First of all, he just tells us what are the primary sources, what do they say, how do we read them properly, and he outlines that. And then what he does is he does what's complicated but very important. He does a cross-cultural examination where he compares and contrasts this rite with Christian rites. This is complicated, but this is still important historical work. And he says, well, the Jews were not the only ones living in Europe at the time who had these kinds of initiation rites. Their Christian neighbors did as well. And part of this larger movement in historiography is to argue that the way that we've thought about Jewish-Christian relations over the course of the centuries, or decades at least, is also somewhat simplistic. How do we think of it? We think of
persecution.
Right, persecution. Antagonism, Jewish-Christian polemic, right? These are the things we talk about. Right? People, if you ask a Stam person on the street, ask them, you know...
Disputations.
You know, disputations. Ask them, when did ghettos start? Right? Many people walk around assuming that all of our medieval Jewish communities Jews were in ghettos.
It was in Italy. Right?
That was in Italy. But other than that, and Prague later on. But basically, it was almost non-existent. The notion of a Jewish ghetto. There were Jewish quarters or sections, but they were not walled off, and Jews lived right next to their Christian neighbors. There are examples of edicts that the church issues declaring that, forget where they lived, where their synagogues were built, vis-a-vis their churches. So you've got a synagogue right down the block from a church, and you've got letters that are written to even as high as the Pope, saying this is unacceptable, this is degrading to the Christian faith, how could they allow the synagogue to be built within just 50 to 100 yards or whatever it was of the church. That was the reality. So we tend to think of everything as just antagonistic and distanced. But the truth is that there was plenty of antagonism at a variety of points, but there was also tremendous amounts of interaction, commercial relationships. Rashi himself probably worked with Gentiles. Many of the greatest of scholars, and certainly the Amcha, they worked with their Christian neighbors. That was their only choice. If you're doing money lending, and you're lending money because you're a Jew, so you can lend to Gentiles with interest, but the Christians couldn't engage in usury, so you've got Jews lending to Christians. So what does that mean? That means that we're talking all the time. That means that my business partners are Christian, not just Jews. We know this, but what are the ramifications in terms of the cultural overlap, and they're dramatic. So there's a tremendous amount of cultural exchange between Jews and Christians at this time, and part of the thrust of these historians is to say, well, what was going on, and what were some of the conversations, either explicit or implicit, between the variety of cultures at that time? And what you have is, Marcus does is he compares the Jewish initiation rite to the Christian initiation rite. He points out that there are some similarities. But then he points out what are some of the differences. And perhaps the Jewish initiation rite is intentionally different. I mean, there's some obvious differences, like the Torah and so on and so forth. They're the ones that you would expect, and those are obvious. But there are also other subtle sort of digs at the Christians and some of, and these kinds of things. We're doing it differently than you, or this is how we do ours. And you have this. He talks about how there used to be, part of it was that they would walk the child to the riverside as part of this initiation rite. And so you have the comparison between water and Torah, and so that was one piece of it. So there's a cultural analysis of what's the symbolism of walking through that public space. Because, of course, the public space was essentially a Christian space. And so he reads it as a symbolic act of saying, this is going to be your life. You're going to be walking in this culture through Christian spaces your entire life. are you going to be able to emerge on the other side, not only physically unscathed, but religiously still committed, and go and lap up the water, as it were, that is by the riverside, as part of your ongoing commitment to Torah. So you're just taking a walk, but it's viewed symbolically, ritually, as a sense of dialogue with, but rejection of, certain aspects of the Christian sphere. So this is how he analyzes. So there's just a tremendous interweaving and complexity to the relationship between Jewish and Christian symbols, which is not to conflate them, but which is to deepen our appreciation for what each faith was trying to do, and some of the responses that the Jewish rituals were engaging in when they developed in parallel to some of their Christian neighbors. So that's some of the work that Marcus does, and he published a book in, I think, 1999 or so, which is completely dedicated to Jewish child's initiation rites. And this is part of a completely different way of thinking about Jewish history, because it's not about the Crusades, it's not about Rashi, it's not about Tosos, it's not about polemic, it's not about blood libels, it's about everyday life. And it wasn't with the big rabbi. It might have been with the big rabbi, but every single kid had this ceremony. And so he analyzes that. So what I'm doing today is to take another example of this. It's a woman who's doing some fantastic work, a real leader in the field. She's written two books over the last decade on this subject of the everyday life of Jews living in Christian Ashkenaz, or in Ashkenaz. Her name is Elisheva Baumgarten. This is her earlier book. This, I think, is 2004 or so. Mothers and Children, Jewish Family Life in Medieval Europe. Yeah, 2004 by Princeton. I will pass it around.
But is she in her late 20s? She's like a really young woman.
Her uncle
is Rabbi Gross. I believe it's the same person, Rabbi Yonah Gross.
Really?
Is that the connection you're talking about?
Awesome. No, she's
from Philly.
But you don't know how old she is, right?
I don't know how old she is. I don't think she's 29. She published this book in 2004. She would have had to be 17 when she published
it. Maybe someone with the same name. It could be the same name.
Well, she's got some Philadelphia. She's
interesting. Okay, I'd be curious to hear more.
Yeah.
Franny Poffinger. Okay, great. So she also has a newer one, published over the last year or so. The problem is that it's about $80 on Amazon. And that's for the used copy. So I haven't gotten it quite yet. I'll wait until the market drives it down. But I guess she's that good. And that's also about... It's about sort of halakhic lifestyles in the 12th and 13th century, but it's not about what some rabbi paskened or ruled, but it's about everyday life as lived by members of the community. Really interesting stuff. And groundbreaking. A new perspective on the study of really of Jewish history in general, but in particular medieval Jewish history. This book traces essentially what happens from pregnancy, in other words, it's a book about birthing, basically, from pregnancy through basically that initiation rite, kind of ends up. It ends where Marcus picks off. She's writing after Marcus, so it's not written in order in that way. It's like, go read, that Marcus wrote the next chapter, but that's basically what it is. And she wants to analyze, but not just tell us, okay, what happened. Yes, we have to reconstruct the facts on the ground in order to analyze them properly. So you need to do your spade work. But more than that, what is the larger significance of some of these phenomena? So she analyzes in this book, she starts with birth and even before that, struggles with fertility. She talks about how the community dealt with infertility. How did they treat it medically at that time? What did they assume about the male, about the female, in terms of who, for lack of a better term, was responsible medically for the shortcoming, and how they grappled with that as a community. Not only their medical practices, but what were the social ramifications of that at that time. This is something that our community continues to struggle with, a very important topic. She talks about the role of midwives in the birthing process. The preference was to have a Jewish midwife, but it was not always possible. There were cases when you had Christian midwives, created complications. But you have these kinds of situations that she discusses. And she then discusses, she has a feminist angle, that's her interest. So what she does is she analyzes, but she's not interested in, like, she's not that she has a particular agenda, but she's using that as just an academic tool to analyze medieval Jewish history. So what she does, for example, she analyzes the role of the husband and the wife in the birthing process. No, the wife's roles a little bit more obvious than that of the husband, but we have these interesting questions nowadays. You know, where's the husband, you know, during childbirth? You know, to be here, it used to be, I think, just a few decades ago that it was probably much less common. I would venture for the husband to be, you know, in the room or immediately present. So there have been some cultural shifts even in recent years, but certainly there were no men even close, anywhere close, to the birthing room where the midwives, like, that just wasn't happening. No interest, no way, no how. That was a female space, And so she talks about the role that the husband had. Was he completely excluded? He actually would very often hire the midwives. Because, right, that was considered his responsibility. He would also fetch the midwife, you might imagine. And so when the woman says, I think it's time, so it'd be the husband's responsibility. This is a practical matter, of course, to go and to find the midwife. Right? He couldn't just make a quick phone call and you know, or shoot over a text or something like that and get them to come over. Right? It required, presumably they had to be nearby around that time. It was understood that he had to go find her to bring her. But she analyzes this not just practically, but sort of what does this say about men's role in the birthing process, women's role in the birthing process? Does the man have any part in this process? What did that look like? What did that mean to them and for the community at that time? And she talks about how she then moves to talk about circumcision, and she sort of sees circumcision, the Brit Milah, as a transitional moment, at least when it was a boy, between the husband really not having an immediate role, but having sort of just a peripheral role to play in the birthing process, to now you're naming the baby, the husband's the one who's naming the baby, and now the husband is somehow more integrated, or now playing that partner role in the raising of the child. Now, of course, in the Middle Ages, that did not necessarily mean that the husband was getting up in the middle of the night. okay, so we have to be honest about the realities back then. For better or for worse, it was what it was. But it did mean that there was, you know, more of a role, and sort of that he then, this sort of a transition from a female space to one that expanded to include others as well. So this is the kind of work that she's doing. And then I want to talk about circumcision today, so I'm going to leave that for a moment, and then we'll come back. And then later on in the book, in some of the latter chapters, she discusses, for instance, other birth rituals. It was a highly superstitious time. So she talks about three of them. She talks about what was called the Halakreish. The Halakreish, which I will gladly spell for you.
Are we talking about the 1200s, 1000s?
Sorry, yeah, I should have said. She's talking mostly about the High Middle Ages. So the book starts with 11th, 12th century, but it's mostly moving into the 13th and early 14th centuries. That's the major point of emphasis, but it covers all of those dates, pretty much. She talks about what's called the Halakreish. She talks about this you may have heard of, the Wachnacht. Anyone?
No.
And then the last one does not have a German name, but basically the Shabbat, a return to Shul, when the mother, probably didn't call it Shul, but when the mother would, after a number of weeks or a little more than a month, would first return to Shul. There was a ceremony around that. So what are these three? So the first, the Halakreish, is essentially the granting of a non-Jewish name. And you have, it's very interesting, they had a ceremony. You know, nowadays, it's just on the birth certificate, maybe, for example, or something like that. If you have, right, if you can give a Jewish name and give it a secular name, so then maybe you put the secular name on the birth certificate, maybe not, or whatever it is. But back then, they actually had a whole ceremony around this. And there's a big discussion as to what the meaning of this ceremony was. They would give the non-Jewish name, and there were rituals that they would perform. And so she discusses what was the purpose of this ceremony, what did it represent, what did it symbolize. And there's a lot of fear about baby snatching back then. It might sound, again, it might be foreign from experience in that way, but there was this concern. There's a famous demon that we might have heard of at one point or another known as Lilith. Might be a familiar name. There was an earlier version of Lilith, or a different version that had the name of Frau Hold, believe it or not. And that was believed by both Jews. I mean, this is how they lived. It was the Middle Ages. And they were afraid that the Frau Hold, this demonic personality, would come and take away the babies. And so there were rituals in both the Jewish and Gentile community, Christian community, in terms of somehow warding off this demonic force. The Batnacht was a meal that was held at the house of the newborn the night before a Brit Milah. So this is for boys. And interestingly enough, she discusses the fact that they had wafers at this meal, and that there was, again, a similar ceremony the Christians had, and they would actually often buy the wafers from the Christian neighbors. It's just complicated. But then they would take the Christian wafer, which a Christian might use for their own sacrament, and now they're taking it and they're using it to celebrate an event the night before a circumcision, which the Christian neighbors are not required to do. So there's a lot of this, again, this interplay that's taking place. And then this is when she returned to shul, there's a parallel Christian practice of going to church also, churching, when the mother would return, and so she has some discussion about what that represents. The thrust of her presentation is not to say, again, like Marcus, is not to say Jews and Christians were just doing the same thing each in their own ways. That's not her point. Her point is rather that there were overlapping concerns. People who lived maybe different faiths, but lived together in the same world with a lot of the same beliefs, other than aside from some of their core faith commitments, and that there was a sort of a borrowing of different rituals. But then, when we borrowed, we didn't just mindlessly do it. We would borrow it, but remake it in the image of our own faith. Sometimes even as a dig at another faith, and other times just do it in our own way. And so she's very explicit. She says it's not to diminish difference. That would be inaccurate. And that would be unfair, but it's to have a richer appreciation for the kind of complex interplay between the different cultures.
Does she look at borrowing on the Christian side, borrowing from the Jewish?
So that's not her emphasis, because her research is focused on the Jewish material, and they're sort of extant. You know, so she doesn't do it as much, because that's not her area of expertise. In general, historians tend to think that if you have a majority culture and a minority culture, it's more common for it to be that the minority culture will borrow but reshape. But she does not, by no means does she think that that's the exclusive, that it's a one-way street. But I think she tends to think that that's probably a more common phenomenon rather than the other way around. She then comes to wet nurses. To nurses. And here also, they would very often end up hiring Christian nurses for their babies. For sometimes as long as, you'll forgive me, just saying, 4 or 5 years. So, this has been in the news. Not just now, but in the news. So, that happened on occasion, but certainly for a minimum of 2 years, it was typical. And very often, there'd be someone who was hired. Again, if you could find a Jewish person, do it, great. But very common to end up hiring a Christian wet nurse. And there are all sorts of responses about this issue as well. What are the halachot involved? And there was a prohibition in the Gemara not to take the child to their own home. And that was a major point of discussion for safety concerns. So that got some pretty extensive literature. There were kashrut issues also that came up, not just in terms of the nursing, but just she would bring in her own food and these kinds of things. But this just gives us a sense as to how common it was for there to be a Christian wet nurse basically living in a Jewish home for years and years and years at a time. So again, the ghetto, it ain't happening. It's just not what it was. So and that doesn't mean that there was not distrust and that there were not issues. There were major issues. And some there were fights and there were promises that were broken and there were economic disagreements about the commitments of the wet nurse and their salaries, and she committed to one family and she committed to another family and these kinds of things. They have all of that.
I just want to point out there were also many Christian servants who worked in Jewish homes, and that also became a very strong point of contention, because the church objected to this going on, this sort of this, sort of subordinate role that Christians played in Jewish homes,
sure.
and the Judaization that they were afraid of. And it actually happened in many cases.
Mm-hmm.
We know of many cases where the Christian servants embraced Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
It was more common for the pagan servants to mm-hmm. do that, but
right.
many Christian servants who came from nominally Christian backgrounds mm-hmm. and really never experienced religiosity within a home, and they embraced Judaism, and the numbers were so significant that the Pope actually issued some encyclical, I believe, which banned or restricted mm-hmm. the extent to which Christian servants could
right.
Be employed by Jews. In fact, there were some popes who actually banned it altogether and said it wouldn't be allowed, and the punishments were severe
mm-hmm.
for those who violated it.
Yeah, 100%. I think I saw John of Chrysostom at one point, and he also, this is someone who is a virulently anti-Semitic preacher, and I think this was one of his major concerns.
Right.
He was seeing that, especially in this servant relationship, servant-master relationship, this inversion, and then this religious danger that went along with it.
But so she doesn't 100%. Deal with that at all in her book?
That's not her emphasis here. No. Okay, so she talks about a number of the responsa around the nursing and all of that, and then she comes toward the very end of the book talking about parent-child relationships, things like that, just at the very young age and caring for the child, etc. I wanted to take one chapter that was really striking to me. It's just sort of a case study for this, and that's her discussion of circumcision. And again, as uncomfortable as it might seem at first glance, it is fair to raise the question as to the parallels between a Jewish ceremony, at least for the boys, and the Christian ceremony, which would be, what would be the parallel? If there was a rough parallel, again, it's not an equation at all. What would be a rough parallel in the Christian community to a circumcision ceremony?
It
would be a baptism. Right? So she's sort of thinking about it along those lines. What are the similarities? But of course, the differences between them reflect about the Jewish community or Jewish culture at the time. Are there significant overlaps? Are they in dialogue with one another at all? And in general, not just in terms of the comparison, what does the circumcision ceremony and everything surrounding it, what does it tell us not just about the halachic issues, but also about the cultural and social questions surrounding the Jewish community at that time? So she spends a chapter discussing this issue, and I wanted to kind of bring it forward. So the first point that she makes is that if we're going to even think about a comparison between circumcision and baptism, is that we have to make a couple of points from the outset. Not only are they clearly different, but there are some very basic distinctions between them, other than the obvious in terms of what you're actually doing. And whether there's pain involved in such obvious distinctions. First of all, baptism applies, of course, to both genders, right? Whereas clearly circumcision does not in the Jewish tradition. That's a clear difference. She also points out that part of it needs to be discussed against the backdrop of when baptism was performed. Remember, in the earlier centuries, at least, of the development of Christianity, it was not uncommon for the baptism to be performed not during childhood or not as a, you know, as a 1-year-old or 2-year-old, but rather as an adult, as an emerging adult. You have that nowadays, right? In a few what are considered to be different or opposing outside the mainstream quote unquote Christian sects. Who do you have that with? I spent the summer with some of them, the Amish, the Mennonites, etc. Right? I believe the Mennonites have it as well. Right, one of the fundamental differences between the Amish church and the mainstream Christian church is that the Amish believe that baptism must be voluntary to be effective. This whole year we have the Rumspringa, right, where they have the children running wild. Familiar with this? When they have to make a decision, and before that they have a year or more in which they're able to roam free. So they have these incredibly enclosed lifestyles that they don't have exposure to much of anything, and then all of a sudden they roam the world free, and they've done films around this, and they've done, maybe some have seen this, what was the name of that movie? Devil's Playground, I think is the name. It's a fascinating documentary basically about Rumspringa, and it follows these Amish kids as they grapple with this year and are trying to figure out what to do with their lives. But
that
the
their gap year, I guess.
That was their gap. I mean, hopefully it's a little bit different than our gap year. Hopefully it's not even our senior year. The sense that they have a year to kind of find themselves, right? But the theological basis for this phenomenon is the notion that baptism must be voluntary, and that was not an uncommon view in the earlier centuries of the church. Over the course of time, especially into the Middle Ages, that was done away with, and baptism could be involuntary. Obviously, probably most, I don't want to speak for Christian theology, but obviously as a practical matter, I would imagine that it was probably deemed more effective to just have it done as a child rather than allow them to make their decision later on. But I don't know what the reasons were and what the theology exactly was, but that certainly was a shift. So by the time you get to the Middle Ages, the majority certainly practiced, the predominant practice was that baptism was taking place already at a young age, and so there's some parallel there as well. So you certainly have that. Another point that she makes, just observing the phenomenon of baptism, is she speaks about the notion of co-parenting, which is kind of like what we call a godfather or a godparent, co-parenting. What they would do is the parents would invite some symbolic parents, quote-unquote, who would officiate or assist with or being otherwise involved with the baptism ceremony, and it was a statement of affinity, of connection between the family of the parents of the child and this other family, and it was a way, there's actually some discussion as to what the purpose was in a social sense. What did it accomplish? Because it's not essential to the baptism. You can be yotzei your baptism without the co-parents, without the godparents, as it were. So what role did it play? And there's been some anthropological and sociological analysis as to what the purpose was. There's actually a breakthrough study that was done by two scholars, and what they found was that in lower class societies, the purpose was to connect with a family that might be able to help provide for the youngster and for my family. And in higher class families, middle to upper class families, it was a social decision in which it was a way of building alliances almost. It's almost a somewhat political move, as it were, but not in the nominal political sphere, but in terms of allying ourselves with a powerful or influential family. That was a common motivation for doing this. Sometimes it would be a family member, like a grandparent or something like that, but often it was not, and that's her suggestion. We're going to look at this because we have not exactly the same notion of co-parents or godparents or whatever, but we have a little bit the kvater, which is going to be part of it. The kvater is that's the German Yiddish term for the one who brings the baby into the synagogue. But then you also have what's the most prominent role, right? The sandak, right? Now it's interesting because if you would ask me who's the most important person here. I don't know, I might say the father, right, or the mother, or I might say the father is the one who halachically has the obligation, right? Or I might say the mohel, right? I mean,
sure.
I mean, you would think, right, it's hard to do the milah,
yeah,
without the mohel. The sandak is the most important. I mean, like, anyone can sit there and hold it. You don't even need a sandak. I mean, you could hold the child securely. There's no reason the baby has to be in someone's lap. Right. And yet somehow the sandak, and we'll see this evolving over the course of our period of time, became incredibly prominent, incredibly important. So Karlbach's another scholar. We should have Karlbach also doing some really important work in early modern Jewish history. Social. Baumgarten, rather, does some great work comparing and contrasting, again, between the co-parents and the idea of having a sandak, or what was originally known in this time as the Baal Brit. Balbrit, and we're going to talk more about that. Now, the notion that baptism and circumcision could be comparable on some level, she has a quotation to that effect. There was an author living in the 11th to 12th century. His last name was Eichenbaum, and he writes a sort of a Christian novel of some sort. And in that book, the quotation, at least translated to English, of course, is as follows, and she cites it here. Says that one of the characters in that novel says, "The baptism of Jews includes a particular custom. They perform it by cutting." Forgive the language. They perform it by cutting. It's a little bit jarring. But the notion that, oh, the Christians were viewing this as somehow the baptism of the Jews, which of course it wasn't. It's very different in so many ways, but apparently there was some notion that their parallel processes of taking an individual and bringing that person into the community, into the faith, at this young, tender age, in a statement about participating in the community. Now, when Baumgarten suggests is that the best way to analyze the symbolic significance of these rituals is looking not just at what happened, but who played what role. She cites other historians who are doing this in other areas and say, they suggest that if you look at who has what role, that can reveal much about the social dynamics that are at play. Who does what, when, why, where is a very interesting lens through which to analyze this issue, and that's exactly what she proposes to do. So again, she's taking this scholarly methodology that has been employed in other areas and in other communities at other times, and she's applying it to these kinds of rituals in medieval Ashkenaz and seeing what emerges. That's essentially what she's doing. So it's really groundbreaking, again, in the sense that although she's not developing a completely new set of historical tools, she is applying them to a time in history where we really have not had very many sustained efforts to analyze these phenomena in quite these ways. So here's what she talks about. The first one she talks about is the baby, because the baby has an important role here. Maybe not very active, but the baby plays an important role nonetheless. So the first thing is that the child, she analyzes what role or what's happening with the baby, and she develops the idea that we had mentioned earlier, which is the notion that the baby is really shifting spaces, right? That earlier, remember, where was the baby? The baby was in the birthing area, surrounded by women, by the mother, by the midwife, by anyone else, by any other caretakers. There were female friends who might come and bring food. I mean, the man was out. There had nothing to do with it consistently over the course of this period of time in these cultures. By the time we get to the circumcision, though, that's a moment, and we don't have it ritualized for a girl, but at some point when the girl goes home, there's going to be that transition. So with the male child, at least, that was formalized in the form of the circumcision. Not that that was the purpose of a bris milah, God forbid, I want to be clear. Bris milah has its own religious purposes, and that's not what she's talking about over here. But what she's saying is the dynamics surrounding the bris milah, which might be culturally dependent, those did shift over the course of time, or those could be located in terms of the dynamics of a particular community. And so she suggests it's about that shift of location and of connection and sort of joining the home unit that includes males, that includes the husband, that includes the siblings, family friends of a wider range as well. So that's in terms of the baby. Now, in terms of the mohel, so she gives relatively short shrift to the mohel, because one of the fascinating things in the medieval community is that the mohel did not seem to play such a prominent role in terms of the discussions. There were halachic questions about the circumcision and so on, but as we'll see, the emphasis in many of the sources was not about the mohel so much. There's some discussion that she has, but that's not her major point of emphasis, which really leads her to her central discussion, which is this notion of this Baal Brit, and who was this Baal Brit, and what does that mean? The idea, the term sandak is a later terminology. So here I brought some texts that are relevant. So first of all, I gave you, if you're interested, on the left of page 61 here, you have a depiction side by side in the same mural of a circumcision, and then below obviously is the baptism. And just to get a sense as to how similarly they were portrayed, at least in this particular painting, right? You've got. It's a little bit different, but you have sort of a similar. You have the child or the people who are being baptized. This looks like adults, which is very interesting in the baptism. So it's right. That's a differentiation. Well, that's what we said earlier. But you have right the actors, and you have the people upon whom it's being acted. You have a number of children, just like you have a number of adults. And so the entire presentation gives you senses to some of the perceived differences, but also similarities between the processes.
I also noticed the difference between the headdresses.
Yeah. Way of differentiating. This is common. This is masim shebechol yom, common medieval stuff. Yeah. We don't quite have a horn, but you get the idea. Okay. Yeah, the Jews were almost always depicted very differently. We had pointy hats, generally unattractive in many of these portrayals. Okay, if you take a look on the next page, so this is, she's tracing it historically here, talking about the different participants. So she first gives us the earliest detailed descriptions, the bottom left of page 62, the earliest detailed description of the circumcision ritual in Ashkenaz, which appears in Machzor Vitri. Machzor Vitri is a compilation of halachot written by the students of Rashi. So if Rashi dies in 1105, so this is late 11th, early 12th century compilation from Rashi's students. On the eighth day of circumcision, they rise early to the synagogue to pray, and they light the candle, they set up two chairs, and they spread a mantle, probably a Torah mantle, or something of beauty to adorn it. One chair is for Elijah, who comes in and sits there, so we have Eliyahu HaNavi as part of the process, and sees the commandment being performed, so this legend that Eliyahu HaNavi is present and is watching, we have here in Machzor Vitri. One chair is for the Baal Brit, who sits in it with the child on his knees. Cloths are brought there for the circumciser to clean his hands with them, and they wash the child in warm water. They dress him in fine clothes, cloth gown and an overgarment, and a beautiful hat for his head. So they dress him up. So some families dress up I haven't seen for a bris milah. I've seen for maybe a pidyon haben. But they actually dressed up the 8-day-old child for the bris milah, as if he were a groom. Wow. They carry him with pomp to the synagogue after the prayers. So this is also interesting. She points out that in Mishnaic times, Talmudic times, the Brit Milah very often took place not in the shul, in the home. The discussions in the Mishnah about whether they could carry the Milah knife to the home on Shabbat if there's no Eruv. How do you do that? Involve the Gentile? What can we do? So the location changes. Baumgarten suggests that this reflects a fundamental shift in terms of the centrality of this ritual to communal life. If you're doing it at the shul, you're shifting it there, so then you're making a statement about its centrality as part of our communal celebrations. The people in the congregation rise to their feet for him when the child enters, and they say, "Blessed he who comes." We still say that, Baruch Haba. The bearer says, "In the name of God, B'Shem Hashem." A little bit different. That's not true. We still have that as well. He just keeps on going. There's a lot more that he says, but he says, we say Baruch Haba, B'Shem Hashem, and then he goes. The ball continues. The father of the boy, it's actually interesting. Sorry, I didn't notice this before. The bearer says, nowadays the mohel says a substantial amount, but this is actually the bearer. This is the kvater, or the balbris, or something like that. The sandok. Someone else, in the name of God. And the father of the boy takes and blesses him to enter into the covenant of Abraham. Those standing there say, as he has entered the covenant, Kishim shenechmas abrit, ken yikanes the Torah luchu palamas into Abraham, which we have nowadays. Father gives the infant to the Baal Brit, and the Baal Brit sits in a chair and takes him in his hands. Circumciser recites, blessed art thou who has commanded us to circumcise, and he circumcises. There's much to say about this. You do have the Baal Brit, you have the shul piece. Where's the mother? Any mother? Who do you think the mother is?
Om.
Right? Things are different. There's no one breathing experience, but on the whole, recovery times have sped up. So she's probably back at home. Now, what's interesting is that there had been an earlier discussion in Jewish history about the role of a female even in the process of circumcision. Because remember, there's a biblical text that's relevant to this. Right? Who does the circumcision? Moses, right? Moshe Rabbeinu's sons did not have a circumcision. Who does it? It's Tzipora. You even have that depiction on the left of page 67 here. See at the bottom, figure 2, Tzipora as circumciser. Nuremberg Haggadah, South Germany, 1450 to 1500. And the psukim from that section of Chumash from Perek Dalet and Shmot are there. It says, Azam, right, says, Chatan Damim Atali, which is the language of Chumash. The left of page 67. See, I have that. So the question is going to be, what could be the role of a woman as a Balat Brit? That's going to be the question. And that's what began to be discussed. But before that even happened, the first thing is that the role of Baal Brit became magnified. And we see that although in earlier stages of history there was no such thing as a tzaddik, you don't find it in the Mishnah, you don't find it in the Gemara, in the Middle Ages it starts to become very prominent. So for example, on page 67, when Rabbi Mari Segel became Baal Brit, this is a later Ashkenazic source, in that which is called tzaddik in the language of the sages, he would wash himself and immerse himself so that the baby should enter the covenant in holiness. And he said, the task of the Baal Brit is more important than that of the Mohel because his feet are like an altar, and it is as if he, the Baal Brit, is sacrificing incense before the circumciser. Okay, so first of all, we have the term tzaddik. Now, this is a 15th century source. This is much later. So you have the term tzaddik, but tzaddik is probably 14th, 15th century. It does not exist in 12th, 13th century, to the best of Baumgarten's knowledge. That's number one. But number two, you get a sense that by the end of the Middle Ages, just how important the role of the tzaddik was. Right? The task of Baal Brit is more important than that of the Mohel. His feet are like an altar. It's as if the Baal Brit is sacrificing incense before the circumciser. Don't tell that to the baby. Don't tell that to the mother. But that's the right, that's the symbolism over here. So the tzaddik is like one who's offering the Keturah. Now, the reward for giving the Keturah in the Beit HaMikdash was, the legend was, or it was considered to be that you would become wealthy if you offered it. That's why they made a decree that you could only offer the Keturah once, and then other Kohanim had to cycle through, and then you can go back, because you want everyone to monopolize all the wealth in the community, so among the Kohanim. So, and remember, the Kohanim usually, very often, they weren't, in theory, they weren't necessarily supposed to support themselves. They're reliant on funds from the community, but they had the Keturah. So that's, but that gives you a sense as to how important this was. This is viewed as a korban. You're bringing a korban, you're more important than the mohel, maybe you'll get rich, it's like the Keturah. I mean, this is really big stuff. If you learn Shulchan Aruch with the commentaries, you'll see the Rama and others all have this idea. They have this notion that it's like Keturah, and then you get wealthy, and that's why they say they shouldn't be two sandeks, so they don't have to split up the money. It's a whole discussion about this idea. It's interesting. It develops at this time, so it gives you a sense as to how important the Baal Brit had become. Now, on page 69, you have another source about the Baal Brit. This is just her pointing out. Sorry, this is the other way, sorry. So the question is where it starts. So she points out that this is a Gaonic source attributed to Rabbi Nissim Gaon. So this is much earlier. This is, let's say, 9th century, maybe 10th century, before the period that we're talking about, and probably in Babylonia, in Baghdad, rather than in northern Europe, or in western northern parts of Western Europe. So this, for example, omits the Baal Brit entirely. The elders of the generation told me that on the day that my father, our teacher, Abba Aluf, brought me into the covenant, they get his priest, when he came to the synagogue with me on his arm, he sat for one moment on the prepared chair, and then he stood up and placed me on the other chair of circumcision. After that, he went out. They asked him what the reason for this was, and he said that he had never seen anyone doing this. So like, what's this? He's talking about what? The Kisei Shel Eliyahu. They put him on the chair of circumcision, and they took him off. They went to know, well, what's this whole putting him on the chair and taking off the chair, right? You know what I'm talking about? The Kisei Shel Eliyahu. So they didn't know what the Kisei Shel Eliyahu was. It was this newfangled thing. And they said, I learned from the elders that this prepared chair is for Elijah. He is the angel of circumcision. I sat on it with the child so that perhaps he would bless the child for me, that he find wisdom in his blessing. Beautiful. That's the Kisei Shel Eliyahu. Where's the Baal Brit? Who's the tzaddik? Were they Yotze? There's no tzaddik. They didn't have a tzaddik. It wasn't so she starts to see, she brackets it. Now, when talking about 9th-10th century, it wasn't essential necessarily, at least in some communities. By the time you come to the end of the medieval period, you're bringing Keturah, and maybe you're getting rich and all these things. So there's this transition, and so she follows it. And it's exactly along these lines. It became more common. Now, then the complication becomes, well, who's going to play that role? And there's this figure, that's not feminine, right? Figurine is small. Now I'm going to get in trouble on the recording.
It's a diminutive.
Unintended. Thank you, Jerry. Right, now it's on you. Okay. All right, fine. So you have this notion of the Balad Brit. Page 70, they brought the baby to the synagogue. The father of the son takes him from the Baal Brit and gives him to the Baalat Brit. This is from Machzor Vitri. This is one manuscript, albeit a later manuscript of Machzor Vitri. Okay? Gives into the Baal Brit. And the people standing there say, "Blessed he is he who comes." The Baal Brit says, "In the name of God," and goes and sits in one of the chairs and takes the baby on his knees, and they circumcise him. Now, she's not the Sandik, but she is playing a role. She takes him from the Baal Brit, and she passes the baby forward as well. Not 100% clear, but there's a notion of Baal Brit, and she plays a role. Now, it's not uncommon nowadays to have a woman play that role. She'll pass the baby in, and then maybe her husband will take the child. The Kvater nowadays is considered often to be a segula for fertility. That's a common kind of thing, and so you have that. You don't have the symbolism here, but you have the notion that there's a Baal Brit and there's the Baal Brit. So you certainly have that. If you look at 71 again, this is not a Baal Brit. This is the wife of the Baal Brit. Okay? So this is a little bit different, but somewhat similar. And the wife of the Baal Brit carries him with splendor to the synagogue. As soon as the congregation has finished their prayers, her husband comes out of the synagogue to meet her. He receives the infant from her and brings him into the synagogue to be circumcised. Congregation stands for when he enters and says, "Blessed is he who comes." Now again, she's not actually walking all the way there, but she's playing some role. And again, you have that nowadays as well. Now what happened is in the 13th century, there was a controversy that developed about a role of a woman even serving as the Baalat Brit in the sense of the Sandik. And this apparently had happened, at least on a few occasions. On the bottom of 71, you have a tshuva to 72, you have a tshuva responsum of the Maharami Rutenberg. The Maharami Rutenberg was one of the outstanding scholars of the 13th century. Tradition is viewed as having died in 1290. She dates it to 1293. The Maharami Rutenberg, for those who are here, actually, I think we may have mentioned it quickly in the past, but he's not someone we focus on because he's an Ashkenazic figure who we haven't quite reached yet in terms of our chronological study. The Maharami Rutenberg, again, is living in Germany in the 13th century. He's jailed by the Christian authorities at that time, and he refuses to allow his children in the community to redeem him, lest they come to ransom more and more for higher sums. He dies in prison. He's buried. Ultimately, his body is recovered by his family in as late as 1304, and he's buried you can go see the kever nowadays in the Worms Cemetery. Actually, 700 years later, plus his kever is still there in Germany, in the ancient Worms Cemetery. So that's the Maharami Rutenberg. And the Maharami Rutenberg was not happy about the practice of a woman playing the role of the Baalat Brit. He opposes it. And some would say stamped it out. He says that it's not that this is something that everyone thought was okay beforehand, and comes along the Maharami Rutenberg and says no, but rather it was generally not the practice, and then some did this, and then he was uncomfortable with it. He writes, "The custom is practiced in most places, not seem to be permissible. Women sits in the synagogue with the men, and they circumcise the baby in her lap. And even if her husband is the mohel circumciser, or her father, or her son, it is not the way of the world that such an honored woman should enter among men and in the presence of the Shechina." You can go on. And you can see his objection, especially since she is not commanded to circumcise, so she doesn't have the obligation. And if it is the case, why should they circumcise in her lap? Right. And he even says, "Thus they, the women, snatch this commandment from the men." Okay, and whoever can object should object, and whoever extrinsically in this case may he be blessed. Mayor, son of Baruch. And he says, no one listened to him about this. Not just nowadays, the rabbis say something, and they say, "Oh, no one's listening to me." There's a long tradition of this. About this, that my teacher has written, and though I have cried out for many days, No one pays any attention. So no one wants to hear this. It says, why was there a women's section in the first place for this? So no one wants to hear it. And he goes on and says, it's better to leave the shul. He's very unhappy about this. Shalom there, son of Maruch. Okay. So she's not so interested in the opposition as much, although that's a piece of it, but sort of this tension, this question. And so she begins to analyze the question, the sort of the different roles of the different personalities here. With regard to, in particular, the Baal Brit, because in medieval Ashkenaz, as we've seen, we have an increasing importance assigned to the stature of the Baal Brit, whether it be male, whether it be female, that whole question. But certainly the Baal Brit has increasing stature. Baal Brit sometimes means what we call the Kvater, the one who brings the child in. Baal Brit sometimes means what we call the Sandek. But you have these different roles, and all of these roles have increasing significance nowadays. By the way, they also came up with a new kibbutz nowadays. They call it the Sandek Me'umad. What this is? So they have the Sandek Me'umad. So if you want to give another honor, what you do is you have one person be the Sandek during the Bris Milah proper, but then when you name the baby, so give the baby to someone else, and they started calling that the Sandek Me'umad. When was that invented? Probably in like 1985. Term. I date it roughly. So right?
There's a relationship that it having to do with longevity and family members that you want to honor.
So that's the question that she starts to ask, is who received this honor? What's the significance of that individual receiving this honor? Why did it develop in the Middle Ages? And what does it symbolize? What does it represent? And that's sort of that's the question that she begins to analyze. And then the parallels to the co-parenting. Right, and so let's come back to the baptism, right, which is where she's been going with all of this. That's why she develops all of this. Yeah, Jeremy.
Had you touched on the two Vachmacht and Shabbat of Return?
I mentioned quickly. Vachmacht was the one the night before. That was the meal with the wafer the night before.
Right,
and then Shabbat of Return. I just mentioned it quickly. That's just part of the larger summary of the book. But yeah, she's got discussions about that, and it also goes to the overlap.
It reminds me, you know, that the Shabbat of Return at El Havdil is when someone isn't finished Shiva and comes in mm-hmm. on Friday night to return after mm-hmm. you know. So again, it's there's a formalization of mm-hmm. the reintegration of that individual back into the community.
Very nice, good, beautiful.
Flip side.
Right, very nice. That's the run. Okay. All right, see you soon. We're finished. Got 5 minutes.
I'm not coming.
Okay. Okay. No, it's no problem at all. Not a problem. Okay, so what are we going to do with this? So what does this represent? So here's basically where she goes. Basically what she suggests. She actually takes it in a different direction, which is unusual. And she suggests that there's something at play here, which she calls, for lack of a better term, reproductive politics. Reproductive politics. Now, that sounds heavy. But what she means by that, and she doesn't mean anything so terrible or offensive by it, although I don't love the term. But what she means by that is that the Brit Milah offered an opportunity for a family to involve someone in their family life. It doesn't have to be so negative. It could be gracious and to bring them into their family and to connect them. Now, who was the Sandek? We really don't know from this period of time, the Baal Brit. It might have been sometimes a grandparent. Very often it was not an immediate relative. We don't know the breakup between those two. It seems that at that time it was often not an immediate relative. She actually goes so far as to suggest that this is connected to a whole other issue that we don't have to get into at length, that has to do with the dowry. And she suggests that essentially there was another phenomenon which had developed parallel to this time period, in which it used to be that when a couple got married and when they had their first kid were often viewed as connected. You know, they used to get married very young. And they weren't even like taken seriously as a family often until their first kid. It's just like, you know, they're married, but like they're not a family yet. And not to like, you know, God forbid, ostracize anyone who wasn't able to have children, you know, at an earlier age, but that was considered to be sort of the consummation almost of the family. What had happened was it used to be that the female family had been the only one to give the dowry. And as the Middle Ages progressed, it became necessary for economic reasons for the husband's family to bring money in as well. The husband's family is generally not so happy about this, but it became an economic necessity, and this is what they began to do. She actually suggests, she has some evidence for this, it's somewhat conjectural, that the Baal Brit was the opportunity to afford the husband's family the opportunity to then gain some, regain some of that luster, that stature, and to involve their own person in that process for one of two reasons. One is because of those economic challenges, they, if they were wealthy enough, they might be able to provide some security. And two, there was a sense that it was a way of allowing them to restore their stature, that there was a sense of social status that was important to the communities at that time, and that the role of the Baal Brit was really the husband's family could choose to involve someone in order to sort of give them a certain, the family has a certain kind of kibbutz. That's sort of her suggestion. So she's saying, in other words, what she's saying is the parts of the milah that are essential to the milah, those are what they are. It's the peripheral parts which start to develop in the Middle Ages that can give us clues as to what was really happening and what really all of this is about. So that's sort of her tentative suggestion. Why the Baal Brit? Where does it come from? And then she makes the argument that co-parenting was very much the same. Not the dowry piece, but it was an opportunity for the family, for the men's family usually in particular, to bring someone, to create an alliance or a relationship, to bring someone into their family who had stature, who maybe had wealth, who had power, who had some sort of substantial role in the community for middle, as I mentioned earlier, from middle to upper cross families. This was the kind of move that they might make in order to build a relationship. So in sum, Baumgarten's argument has really come full circle. You have these parallels between the co-parents and the sanduk. The role of the sanduk of the Baal Brit really evolves from nothing from the time of the Gaonim to become next to the Ketoret by the time you're finished with the medieval Ashkenaz. The significance she locates not in terms of halacha proper only, because this is not an essential part of the milah after all, it's important halachically, but also reflects some of the social trends, tensions, and pressures at that time, which were parallel in the Christian and Jewish community. And so this could exist in parallel because the economic pressures were somewhat different in the Jewish community, but they existed in Christian families and they existed for Jewish families. And so it stood to reason that their similar pressures would lead them to add parallel kinds of phenomena to their respective rituals. Does that mean that they're the same? No. Does that mean that we should conflate everything in the Jewish ritual and that of the Gentile one? Absolutely not. But that there are shared larger concerns and that those can develop in their own ways, but in parallel in each community, that she suggests emerges. And that's sort of an illustration, a case study of her larger thesis in this book. That's just one example. I'm excited to wait till the price of the other book drops. So pick up a copy and then share more about her other book as well. Certainly, if anyone gets their hands on it, let me know. I'd be excited to hear your impressions. But this is, again, an illustration of a larger movement over the last two decades in terms of new approaches to understanding daily life for Ashkenazic Jews and really at any point in Jewish history. I think the really wonderful people doing extraordinary work, opening up new perspectives and vistas for us to benefit from, can really help to round out our class. And so that's what I wanted to do today. Moving forward, we have to do the Baal Yatoso, so that's going to be our next step. So that's going to take us, we had done Rashi, and we're going to go from there. But I wanted to insert this as part of our discussion. Yashikoh.
Thank you.